One of the great unreported stories of recent times is the extent of the persecution of Christians in Muslim countries. In just a moment, Peter Day joins us to talk about this. He's a former journalist whose wife, Heba, is a Copt. Now, the Copts are Egypt's Christians, and Peter has been observing persecution there for many years. Before introducing him, I thought I'd read out a list of just some of the attacks in Muslim countries reported over the past 6 months to give you some sense of our subject. In October last year, 30 Christians were killed after an attack on a church in Iraq. In November, Egyptian police shot three Copts dead at the building site of a church. In December, over 20 Copts were killed in an attack on a church. At Christmas, there were attacks on churches in Nigeria and the Philippines. In January, two churches were burned in Indonesia, which has a long history of deadly attacks on Christians. Last month, a Copt church was burned near Cairo. A Christian was sent to jail in Bangladesh for selling and distributing Christian books. And in Ethiopia, where Christians are actually in a majority, 50 churches and dozens of Christian homes were reportedly burned and thousands of Christians displaced. So we're talking about a fairly extensive phenomenon. Peter Day is a journalist who worked for many years for News Limited. He did lots of things there, including being a foreign correspondent in America. And he now writes for The Spectator and for Quadrant, where he has an article about this very subject. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Michael.
How long has this sort of persecution been going on?
Well, I would date it from the 1970s, Michael, which is really when you had a resurgence of Islamism through most of the countries that you just mentioned. And that was certainly the case in Egypt. From the early 1970s, the era of Anwar Sadat is when I would date it from.
Now, Peter, I know you're most familiar with Egypt. Tell us a bit about the history of the Copts.
Oh, well, there was a time when all Egyptians were Copts. The word Copt just means Egyptian. So they are the descendants of the ancient Pharaonic people. Then, of course, you had the Islamic Arab conquest in the early 7th century. And Egyptians were still called Copts up until, maybe 10th, 11th century, something of that order. It just means Egyptian. So they, their history is a very ancient and a very distinguished one.
But gradually over the centuries, the proportion of Christians got smaller and smaller, did it?
Yes, it did. So by, say, about the year 1700, the proportion would have been about 25%. And since then, it's continued to slide. I'd think about 1950, it might have been 15%. Mm-hmm. Now you're down to about 10.
And what's their situation like there? How are they treated?
There's a lot of low-level discrimination which goes on, which is sort of at a social level. There's a lot of professional discrimination goes on in employment. And this is all sort of accompanying a general Islamization since the 70s, as I was talking about. And every now and then, you get an explosion of violence to go with it. When I say every now and then, maybe two or three times a year, you'll get an attack on churches getting burnt down or Coptic shops or houses, that sort of thing.
Mm, and churches seem often, not just in Egypt, to be a sort of a flashpoint, don't they? Do the Christians, the Copts in Egypt, have enough churches?
Well, I mean, that's a question of judgment, isn't it? They certainly don't think they do. The thing there is, it goes back to something called the Humayun Decree, way back to the early years of the Islamic conquest, but it's still in place. And it means that to build a Christian church, or in fact any non-Muslim house of worship, you have to get presidential approval, and you have to go through all sorts of bureaucratic hurdles, which can take up to 20 years. So this is something certainly which mightily annoys the Copts. I think I should stress that, from the mid-19th century up to the mid-20th century, the Copts were leaders in Egyptian society, across the economy, socially, and every other way. And there was pretty much not only complete tolerance, they were an admired people. It's a very changed situation.
Well, what about the life of your wife, Heba, when she was in Egypt? How was that affected by the fact that she was a Christian?
She grew up in the era of Nasser. Gamal Abdel Nasser was the leader of the coup of 1952, which destroyed the old Egyptian constitutional order and its parliamentary democracy. He basically put in place a dictatorship, and it's the same regime which exists today. So under Nasser, when she was growing up, Nasser simply stole huge chunks of the economy, which he distributed to his mates in the army, and the Copts were among the primary victims of this. So it's from the 1950s that you start to get Coptic immigration to places like Australia, also United States, Canada, Europe. That's been our gain, but Egypt's great loss, because these were really people among the elite of society who had skills, education, resources, and so on.
Why was that as a matter of interest? Why were the Christians amongst the elite of society in those ways?
Well, I think the Christians back in the late 19th century were really in the forefront of establishing an educational system, a modern educational system in Egypt, and that included education for girls. They've always put enormous stress on education. You know, in some ways it's a bit loose, but you could almost compare them in some ways to, say, the Chinese in a place like Indonesia. They put a great stress on family life, great stress on education, and this naturally just produces leadership in whatever it is, the arts, business, intellectual life, and they were certainly up there.
So were they prominent in business in the way that the Chinese have been in Indonesia? Because if that was the case, then I suppose that does make them a target for resentment at certain times.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to draw the parallel too far. Mm. Certainly, they still are leaders in a lot of business. The Sawiris family of Egypt is, last time I looked, they were in the Forbes top 200, I think, the richest, but very rich. They're Coptic people. And they run, you know, Egypt's telecommunications business. But Copts are spread throughout society. The famous garbage collectors of Cairo, the Zabalin, they're mostly Coptic.
You've talked about some of the persecution. To what extent is the government involved in that? And to what extent is it a purely, as it were, spontaneous or populist phenomenon?
In the 70s, it was a populist phenomenon. Nasser was basically a left-wing government. Sadat came to power. He wanted a new power base. And he basically put his foot down on the old Egyptian left. And his new power base was the Islamists. He wasn't aware of just how difficult they were about to become. And that led to a great deal of sort of bottom-up trouble for the Copts. Under Mubarak, if you fast forward a bit, the government has been involved. Mubarak has used anti-Coptic sentiment as a way of deflecting anger from his own regime when he was in power, before February 11, when he fell, of course, and turning that towards the scapegoat, the Copts. So the Mubarak government, through his security forces, his police forces, used the bigotry of the masses, if you like, to political effect.
Mm, and what were some of the ways he did that? I mean, for example, what were some of the accusations or allegations the government made or caused to be made against the Copts?
I don't think they did that, really. They didn't have to do that. They simply allowed these allegations to be spread through the media. You've had, for example, Saudi-financed extremist preachers spreading accusations that, for example, Coptic monasteries are stashing weapons away and that they plan to establish a breakaway state and to destroy Egypt. These sort of rumours just spread like wildfire. It doesn't need any government direct encouragement at all. The problem is that the government then doesn't protect the Copts and it doesn't bring the perpetrators of the violence to justice. This is the main Coptic complaint.
Can you tell us about a fairly recent example of that? I think there have been some, haven't there, where there was violence actually occurring against Copts and the government forces were nowhere to be seen for quite a long time.
Well, you know, there was that terrible bombing in Alexandria on New Year's Day, about 10 minutes past 12 on New Year's Day this year, which killed, I've forgotten now, maybe 20 people and injured many others. And there was supposed to be protection at the churches because there'd been a lot of warnings. There'd been a lot of violent demonstrations outside that church in Alexandria going back for weeks. And somehow or other, the protection wasn't there. And then, of course, you have, typically in these situations, you have an awful long time bringing anybody to justice, and quite often nobody is.
Is it possible to say whether much has changed since the political events of February?
Well, there's enormous hope, of course, Michael, that it would change. The Copts were there in Tahrir Square. It's not just the Coptic people, remember. It's all of the non-Islamist forces, the human rights people, the young people in the left-wing movements. All these people, for all of them, the Copts are a sort of test case. They're the yardstick. Is Egypt going to become a pluralist society? Is it going to have human rights? Is it going to be a tolerant place? Is it going to have a decent civil society? If you want to answer these questions, you just have to look at, how the Copts are being treated. And that's why a lot of these human rights groups are very, very interested in the situation for the Copts.
Mm. And what are some of the signs that might indicate in the future that things are getting better? For example, are there specific laws discriminating against Copts that one would hope to see changed?
I think the number one, if there's one thing, it is the legal requirement that every Christian identify themselves as a Christian on their ID card. This keeps religion absolutely top, front and centre of social life, national life, all the time, and is guaranteed to do it. It has only one purpose. I mean, everybody has to say what their religion is, but you only get two choices. You can be a Muslim, you can be a Christian. So it's really just a way of identifying the Christians, and it just simply facilitates discrimination against them in every way. Any dealings they have with the police forces, with the judiciary, with the bureaucracy, and so on.
Is any of that discrimination, you know, enshrined in law, or is it, as it were, unofficial? In other words, are there specific laws discriminating against Copts?
I think the Egyptian constitution is pretty much unimpeachable. I think it's pretty good. But Egyptian law is officially influenced. It's not based on Sharia, but it is influenced by Sharia Islamic law. And so a lot depends upon the position taken by individual judges in court cases, for instance. They might decide, an argument is allowed from lawyers, that maybe Coptic testimony shouldn't be given the same weight as Muslim testimony would be given.
Your wife, Heber, she still has family in Egypt?
Oh, yeah. We have an extended family in Egypt. I just spent several weeks over there. You know.
Any idea, well, you probably do, what they're thinking at the moment about the hopes for Egypt in the future?
Well, as I say, they had... I know that some of them were down there in Tahrir Square joining in. In some ways, you know, because the Copts in recent times have been engaged in demonstrations against the government, I mean, this is before January 25, of a kind that they never were before, after the Alexandria bombing, for example. The Coptic Church has always preached cooperation with the government and government officials. The younger generation are getting very impatient with that, and they were openly heckling all government ministers and people and saying, you're just not serious. And really, those sort of demonstrations were going on weeks before the January 25.
Back in February, some commentators were fearing that one of the possible outcomes of all that was that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood or Islamist forces might gain a stronger role within Egyptian society. Do you know if that's still a valid fear, if it ever was?
I think just the last two or three weeks, the signs are not good. What you've got is a pretty strongly emerging association between the Muslim Brotherhood and the army. The army, of course, is now running the place until elections, which are due in September. But all of the army's political moves have been opposed by the non-Islamists, the January 25 people, all the young people, those movements. And they've been supported by the Muslim Brotherhood because moves have all of them given the Muslim Brotherhood an enormous advantage in the upcoming parliamentary elections. And that's a very important election because that's the one, well, the parliament elected then will shape the new constitution.
We'll end on that melancholy note, Peter. Peter Day, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Peter Day is a freelance journalist who, as you heard, recently spent some time in Egypt, and he writes for The Spectator and Quadrant. And we'll have a link to an article he recently wrote for Quadrant on this very issue.
Michael, we've got some correspondence here. It's in response to your interview with Josie Appleton last week on the hyper-regulation of everyday life. Now, listener John has this to say. When a colleague and I were working recently in China, we found permission to observe classes in schools, as well as interview students and teachers, was given after talking with the principal. No referral to layers of bureaucracy, as here. On asking if it was okay to take photos, the first response was, "Would you like to borrow a camera?" And on explaining we had our own, "Of course, it's fine. Just ask each student if they mind." This is in communist China, Michael.
I think it's known as subsidiarity in other circles, isn't it?
I think it is, yes.
Another listener, Yvette, has got a nice story for us. She says, some months ago, a friend of mine, who's a respected doctor with a local hospital, as well as a school governor, realised that her blue card, which allows you to work with children, was out of date. This didn't strike her as a problem, as she's gone through a much more stringent check by Queensland Health, which was still current. The school board, however, was quite spooked that the card could be out of date by a few weeks when a school meeting was due. While she went about the process of renewal, she was warned that if she set foot on school property without a renewed card, she'd have to be escorted off the premises. Threats of other calamities were also made. Sadly, Yvette goes on, the school board did not rise up and challenge such nonsense that assumed a well-respected and vouched-for member of the community was effectively assumed to be guilty of something. If there is an Aussie version of Manifesto, I'd like to join up, says Yvette. This over-regulation denies more human rights than it protects.
And that's it for us today. The program is produced by Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is John Magic Fingers Diamond. I'm Paul Comrie-Thompson.
And I'm Michael Duffy. See you next week, same time, same place. But for now, goodbye.